Is he my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone. I'm Veronica Monet, your host, and this evening we've got a rather delicate topic. We're going to be talking about child molestation, but especially as it occurs in religious organizations. We're going to be talking about the clergy. I actually think this is kind of good timing. A lot of us kind of turn back to family and religion and tradition this time of year with the holidays. And for those of us who come from abusive backgrounds, it actually can trigger quite a few memories and issues and feelings. So we're actually going to be talking about this for the next 2 weeks. I have another guest next week who's going to be talking about it as it affects the Orthodox Jewish community. So anyway, we're taking an equal opportunity approach to this really, really important topic, and it's a topic that is very close to my heart as well, because I am a survivor of incest, and I wasn't abused by members of the clergy, but my family used their religious dogma to shelter and to obfuscate the abuse, as far as I'm concerned. So, without further ado, let me introduce our esteemed guest. His name is Dr. Jaime Romo. He's an educator, also a survivor of clergy abuse, and he's authored a book called Healing the Sexually Abused Heart. He is at the forefront of assisting religious communities throughout the U.S., develop both safe church and healing programs. And I'm just going to welcome him into the Shame-Free Zone here, and we've already got something of a buzz going on Facebook. Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone, Dr. Romo. How are you doing tonight?
I'm well, thank you. Thank you.
And where are we actually talking to you? Where are you located tonight?
I'm a little bit north of San Diego.
Okay, so you're a Southern California guy. I'm just wondering if you could share us a few things about your own personal history before we launch into, you know, our more probably esoteric discussion about this. I think the listeners, and I know I would like to know a little bit about your background and what prompted you to pursue this this field of, you know, research. I'm assuming there was a little bit of research that went into the book, but you'll tell us.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the book is, you know, just the result of, you know, a lifetime of my professional background coming together as a researcher and as a teacher educator. So I really help people to look at their own environments and their own identities and figure out, you know, where they really want to be. But this topic, you know, I never thought I would get involved with. I buried, you know, my experiences of abuse by my pastor, you know, for many years. It wasn't that happened when I was an early adolescent, an early teenager, and it wasn't until 2002, when all the stuff was coming out about the Boston clergy abuse, that started to trigger my own memories, and I found that to be a very common experience for many survivors, that when they see other people or some memories, you know, that other people are reporting are out in public, then it helps them to, you know, remember to know that they're not alone, to know that, you know, perhaps it's possible to come forward. So I'll back up a little bit to say that my story is probably similar to lots in that I came from a family that didn't have really good boundaries, you know, caring parents, but also, you know, a violent alcoholic dad who's not real present and So I sought sanctuary in school and in church. And it was my first job, was working in a rectory and working, you know, with this person who groomed and then abused me. And so, like a lot of people, I was vulnerable, looking for that attention. And here's this authority, this representative God who, made himself a part of our family, created this incredible trust. And he was a highly, you know, credible, respected person in the whole diocese, not just in our little part of the town. So those memories were really buried, and I channeled my rage. I didn't know it at the time, because I kind of identified it with being ashamed of being poor and really hungry and my, you know, alcoholic father. Mm-hmm. And so I was very competitive in school and in grades and in sports, and kind of ended up going to Stanford, being a real disciplined person. But then when I got there, I didn't know how to kind of manage, you know, the academics, even though I was a good student before. And so I was kind of wild and just burying all those experiences, I think, in retrospect, trying to numb out. And, had a wild kind of swing where I had a heavy conversion experience, a real deep spiritual experience. And I actually went to the seminary for a few years after I graduated from college and studied as a zealous, you know, spiritual person, studying to be a priest. And then after a few years, stopped out, knew that there was a disconnect in some important emotional parts of my life and my own identity, and then I started teaching. And I applied all that energy and passion to right wrongs and education, and was on that track until 2002.
Okay. What happened in 2002?
Well, I was actually in a week-long seminar for professors working in Catholic institutions, as I was. I was at the University of San Diego. And I was there for a week on the East Coast, and all the stuff with, Boston was coming up. And my sons were about the same age that I was when I was abused. And so when I had those things going on in Boston that were triggering some memories, had some conversations with a brother. Are you there?
Yeah. Sorry about that. All of a sudden my headset went out. Please continue.
Okay. Well, and so
it's 2002. Your sons are about the age that you were when you were being molested.
Yeah, and so I came home with this kind of being disgruntled about the conversations at this week-long program that weren't dealing with Boston, weren't dealing with other issues that I really cared about.
Weren't dealing with Boston, can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, at the time, there were reports coming out about clergy abuse. The Boston scandal was kind of the first in the U.S. to be really, really public. And that was in the news every day. And, I had really identified with Catholicism my whole life. And so we were talking about kind of academic things, but not dealing with what was right there. And I didn't know even then exactly why this was so troubling and upsetting for me. And then when I came home, I didn't recognize, you know, the connection with my sons until I saw one of them laying on my bed. You know, he'd just gone running around or whatever, and so he was taking a nap on my bed with no shirt, and all of a sudden I saw myself as I would have been at that age. And so that's how things started to flash, and it was kind of like the Gulf spill. I all of a sudden, all these things were coming up, and I was getting, you know, bits and pieces of these experiences and, you know, where I was and what kind of abuse it was. And, you know, all this stuff had been buried. So
you had not actually recalled the abuse until 2002.
Right.
Wow. Okay.
So, yeah, so that's a good, you know, 30 years. And that's common. That's common. I think there are a lot of things that need to be in place for a lot of people to bring really traumatic experiences forward, because people really disassociate from their bodies, from their own experiences. And I had finished my doctorate. You know, I was a professor. I had a strong, you know, marriage and, you know, great kids, and so I was really rooted there. And my professional life was good, and I was published, and, you know, writing like crazy, and teaching, and, you know, creating new fields in education. And so there were a lot of good things in place, and I think that's
right.
what made it possible then for me to look deeper.
So what was the first thing that you did then after you have this pivotal, you know, moment in your life of identifying? I'm going to say probably it was kind of an identification of the vulnerability of your sons and then relating that back to your own vulnerability.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't, you know, it's been real clear since then how, and I think it's the same for so many survivors, we become hypervigilant about our kids, you know, sometimes without realizing how much or why.
Right.
But, yeah. I had a conversation with one of my brothers who's a journalist, and as a journalist, he kept asking me questions, and you know, I said, yeah, I can, he encouraged me to report to the diocese of L.A. where this happened. And I naively thought, well, you know, I can do this because, you know, I've done therapy for other things, and I've got a lot of support, and yeah, this is something that happened a while back. You know, it's not reporting for me, it's reporting for someone else so it doesn't happen to others or so they know, because they must certainly want to know. It must be something that they don't realize that has happened. And so I say naively because it's, you know, clearly been proven false. And in fact, the person who abused me, I've only recently, there have been more people who have come forward about that person. But my brother encouraged me, and so I called and ended up getting a call back from somebody from the diocese, and it wasn't very friendly, I have to say, but you know, at least they called.
So when you say they weren't friendly, what was it, just cold, or did they try to push back and warn you not to tell anybody, or?
No, actually, it was mixed. I mean, at first, it was very brusque. I mean, the person said real directly, not hello or how are you or whatever, just what do you want?
Oh.
And I was surprised. I like, wow, well,
wow.
I wanted to let you know. I thought you would, this is important for you to know.
Right.
And afterwards, I think the person was more, I guess, you know, encouraging about finding some kind of support. And
had you gotten any kind of therapeutic or, you know, support at this point, or this is the first thing you do is just reach out to the church?
Well, the therapy and the support that I'd done earlier had related to growing up with, you know, my alcoholic father. So,
right.
You know, adult children of alcoholics. And
yep, been to those meetings myself, even though my parents weren't alcoholics. So.
Yeah, I mean, there's some great value, you know, to hear other people who are kind of wanting to get freed up from old stuff and quit dragging around old things and repeating old patterns. And there's a spiritual quality to those that was always really valuable. But I hadn't dealt directly with the abuse issues until after 2002.
So what happens after you get this, you know, rather cold reception from the church? Do they investigate?
Well, yeah, they said that they would announce, you know, in the parishes where this person served and ask people to come forward. Assured me that he was, although he's still alive and retired, that he would, you know, not have anything to do with any kids, that was the extent of it. He died not too long after that. I was about to actually confront him, and he passed away.
Okay.
And so I took up a role to, you know, channel my, you know, energy and rage in constructive ways, and it became a leader in a group called the SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests.
Ah.
And I took a very active role to, you know, well, it was too soon, really. I should have taken better care of myself, but I was out leading, you know, press conferences and handing out leaflets in front of churches and, you know, leading meetings for survivors and writing letters to editors and all this stuff. So I took up, like, my professional activism kind of role, thinking that I was intact enough that, you know, all the stuff that I was getting exposed to, as well as my own experiences, that they weren't, you know, as damaging or as toxic as they really were.
And I take it that didn't work so well.
Right. It was a few years after that that I was diagnosed with PTSD. So it was really inconvenient, I mean, to be, you know, leading a class and all of a sudden having an anxiety attack or not being able to remember basic things that I've, you know, written or taught for years. That really forced me to stop and to take care of myself. Eventually, you know, led to me leaving the university. And at the time, actually, I was one of the lead plaintiffs in the L.A. Class action with the Archdiocese.
Wow.
And that was probably another reason that I was so, you know, kind of immersed in all this and didn't have any break from that. So
yeah.
All that came together to really be a kind of a meltdown or a deconstruction, you know, just to get back to I have to take care of myself before I can be any of, service to anybody else, and I have to deal somehow with not being able to read and remember and function in a lot of ways that I used to take for granted. So I did that. That was a slow process, beginning with a program at the Chopra Center, not too far from where I live, called Healing the Heart, and it was really an intensive kind of workshop about dealing with really painful things and going back and then realizing, you know, not just what happened to us, but what we've done to ourselves and how we can make choices about being freed up. And that was a pivotal experience. And that helped me to not just let go of some toxic things in the past, but to recognize that I had, you know, taken on some habits that were damaging for me and others. And, I was abandoned, abused, and then lived in shame when I was little. And then I lived with that, and I continued to do that to myself. I abandoned myself. I was abusive. I overworked. I was overdoing everything, and I was never, you know, satisfied or happy with it, regardless of how many degrees or things I had done. And I'm sure I gave that to other people. So I had to recognize my part in doing that to myself. And then, you know, like in the 12-step work, make amends and really make some choices about living and working differently. So that program also connected me with meditation, which was a lifesaver. And I actually became, a couple years later, a primordial sound meditation instructor. And so...
So what is primordial sound meditation?
It's basically a mantra-based meditation. And primordial sound is a particular way that Deepak revived a tradition of transcendental meditation that was linked to one of the Indian, you know, regions, but it's mantra based, and it really helped me to revive, not just to let
Is it you know, just a particular sounds, or are you actually using Sanskrit or some type of language?
Well, it is part of the words. The mantras are in Sanskrit, and so they're not comprehensible. I mean, we don't know what they mean. And it's just sounds anyway. It's not supposed to have a particular meaning. But every person has a particular mantra that basically helps a person to relax their mind and kind of not think about a lot of things. And I found that to be a powerful resource for me. And, I actually think it would be not just helpful for, you know, people who are dealing with stress, and but for survivors in particular, I think it really has expanded me, and that is part of what I put into the workbook as well. So all that was part of my rebuilding, and then the writing of the workbook was looking at, you know, my own experiences and, like a researcher, seeing the patterns and seeing stages and how one thing led to another, and then being able to offer some, you know, reflections and some exercises so the person going through the process could, you know, could make it their own. And
I want to say again to the listeners, the name of the book is Healing the Sexually Abused Heart, but the subtitle is A Workbook for Survivors, Thrivers, and Supporters. So it is, in fact, a workbook. So it's not just a book you're going to read, but it's something that actually can shift your reality if you do the exercises.
Yeah, it's it's not. I wouldn't say, you know, quit therapy. In fact, I would say use it with a therapist or use it with a support group. But it is. I really value process. I wrote a book a long time ago called "Towards Cultural Democracy: The Journey from Knowledge to Action." And so I think there's an awful lot of information, but to move it into action, we have to spend some time with it. We have to process it. We have to make it our own. And that's what the workbook helps with.
So anyway, when did you actually start writing the book? Because the book just came out this year, right?
Yeah. So I started, I guess, the earliest version in about late 2006. And, you know, just have been, you know, at it, you know, in little bits and pieces and going through different versions. And actually ended up talking with a couple of survivors who have lots of experience in their own recovery and who are real spiritual giants. And just in the rounds of getting feedback, then it kind of all crystallized in about 2008. And then I put it all together.
And you're a doctor. I'm just like, what is your field of study? Are you a psychologist?
No, I'm not a psychologist. I'm an educational leadership, and my doctorate is in educational leadership.
Okay.
So that really looks at it. It change really at individuals and in groups and how they change and you know, become more effective at, you know, being our best.
Okay.
And so that was the background that then when I looked at, oh, well, how can I go through change and how can, you know, even a group, like chapter 5 in the workbook is for supporters, and it gives people kind of some maps about, well, is this what your organization is like? You know, how can your organization change? What might be a next step to be more of an ally for supporters and a safer place and a place where people can actually find some kind of you know, sense of safety and healing? So all that background was really useful.
And what if you had to delineate what it is about your book that maybe sets it apart from some of the other books out there? I don't know if you're familiar with Stacey Haynes. She's got a book called The Survivor's Guide to Sex. I'm assuming your book doesn't really focus so much on rehabilitating the sex lives of survivors, but because your focus is more on the heart. But
yeah,
you know, what is it about your book that you think is maybe perhaps the biggest gift that it's offering survivors?
Well, I think the biggest part of it, the core of it, is that it's a spiritual map. I mean, it's I was at one point, you know, like a monk, you know, way back in 84 when I was in the seminary.
Okay.
And I thought I had a lot of kind of spiritual connection and bliss or whatever, but, you know, that was fragmented. I was like a disembodied spirit. And so this has really helped people to go through a process of putting our hearts and minds and our, you know, health back together. So it really has that, not a religious zeal, you know, but it has a spiritual zeal. And it recognizes, I think it's big enough for people coming from all kinds of different backgrounds who may not have had any real mapping of, you know, oh, how can we grow? And especially people who deal with abuse by any authority, but a religious authority who represents God. I mean, then what do we do? What kind of spiritual maps could we find, you know, in that setting? So that's really distinctive. Plus, it's got both the inside out, you know, like the personal, you know, processing. Plus, you know, it's rooted in the research that we know about the impacts of abuse and leadership and how do people, you know, rebuild themselves or, you know, do things that are difficult.
And what would be one of those first steps to rebuilding?
Well, the first is always just to get back in touch with our, you know, who are we? And reconnecting with our physical self and recognizing, you know, where we are. You know, for a long time, I guess I wanted to believe that I was doing better than I really was. And I really need to stop and recognize, oh, I've got a lot of wounds or I got a lot of rage or, you know, I've got these strong reactions. And for some people, we live like with so much grief and so on, that when we don't want to feel that, but then the next thing from that is like feeling rage and recognizing what's happened to us, and then we do this two-step, you know, going back to depression and because, you know, it's not nice to be full of rage. So the first step is really just to get in touch and sit long enough with, you know, our physical state and our emotional state, and ask that basic question, you know, who am I? Not what's happened to me, not what have I done, not what's been done to me. So that's the first step. And then from there, you know, taking care of ourselves. That's a mistake that I made, or an experience a lot of people have, is we rush so quickly to be an advocate for others that we forget to stop and to take care of ourselves and to feel however we feel and ask for help.
I think that's particularly problematic for survivors, because a lot of times there's caretaking of the perpetrator. So that becomes the first intimate relationship that you have, is with being abused and taking care of the perpetrator. Did you ever feel like there was some part of you that was protecting your perpetrator?
Well, I can't say that was conscious, but I imagine, you know, that was really deeply ingrained. I mean, I grew up with such an ethic of respecting elders, and then here was this person who was, you know, the church leader and a, you know, kind of like a high-ranking prince of the archdiocese, and that's one reason that a lot of people don't report, is like, well, this person that everybody believes and loves and, you know, trusts this person, so they must be right somehow, and that wasn't conscious, but I'm sure that was a big part of me just dissociating from all that experience and not dealing with it until it was, you know, impossible to not deal with.
And that is the really noxious part of being abused as a child, I think, is the not trusting of one's own perceptions and feelings, not knowing how to validate those, because you've got an adult or a series of adults telling you that it's not happening, or that it's not as bad as you think it is, or that you feel it is, or that somehow or another you are, quote-unquote, overreacting. There's a lot of different ways that were shamed and controlled by perpetrators. What were some of the things that your perpetrator did? Were you ever threatened, or was it just implicit?
Oh, I think it was more implicit, but there were some classic things about what child abusers do. Is, I mean, engage the victim in behavior that they don't want to report to other people, so they're in this bind, you know. So this guy would take me out to places, nice trips and so on, and then, you know, give me alcohol and go to nice places. And actually, it was kind of strange that I would, you know, was a young teenager, but being served alcohol, you know, at nice mm-hmm. restaurants. So that kind of stuff was really implicit, you know, like how could I acknowledge that there was something not okay with this guy's behavior, because I knew that it was not okay for me to be drinking. I didn't have that kind of explicit threat, although, you know, that is a lot of other people's experience. So that added to my own shame that it was somehow, you know, I didn't speak up. I didn't, you know, challenge that.
Yeah. There's a whole series of things, I think, that are employed to, you know, inculcate us with shame so that we don't talk. That's very important for anybody who's going to perpetrate against a child, is how to keep that child from speaking about it.
Yeah, and I love the title. I didn't, about the show itself, you know, the Shame-Free Zone.
Yeah.
Because that's such a debilitating and imprisoning experience, is the way we internalize whatever happened to us, and then it just becomes, you know, so deep that, I know for me, I mean, it drove me. So for some people, it drives them into self-destruction by dropping out of school or, you know, being self-destructive. I became, you know, self-destructive, I guess, in constructive ways.
Right.
But it was still not good, you know, practices.
It's still an avoidance pattern.
You're
not experiencing your grief and your rage, and you're not really connecting with yourself in an authentic way. One of the questions that I posed to our friends on Facebook here was whether or not the religious leaders and clergy tend to be perpetrators more so than other professions. Like, is there a concentration of child molesters in the Catholic Church or other churches? And before I give you an opportunity to respond to that question, I would like to weigh in and hear, just kind of read a couple of things that Facebook friends had posted.
Okay.
You know, Hannah said it seems like it with the scandal. Tamara says it is brought to light only because the priests are supposed to be so pious. I believe family members molest their children more than any. And then Hannah said, or like you stated, a friend of the family, and it is sad when they think the child wants attention or is lying. Hannah also said she thought teachers are getting worse. And Nicholas says, I suspect Tamara is correct on this one. It's hard to get an accurate statistic because most recent incest victims are likely not to report abuse that would be included in the statistics. Enough do, I'm certain, to render a good guess on how common it probably is based on the usual statistical sampling formula. I had an anthropology professor whose comment on incest and how common it was to say that familiarity breeds attempt, instead of contempt. A lot of attention is given to the clergy because it is such a severe betrayal of trust. There is an argument that the requirement of celibacy for priests makes them especially susceptible to deviant behavior. Much of that goes unreported as well until one victim speaks up and then others may do the same. A certain molestation of children is common, whether it's done by a trusted clergyman or a family member or a next-door neighbor. And Nicholas, by the way, very intelligent parsing out of this issue. Just to kind of highlight what he said there, we're talking about the fact that we focus in on the clergy because it is a huge violation of trust, but probably, you know, although that gets a lot of our attention, there's a lot of stuff that's probably going on unreported, including what takes place in the family or the next-door neighbor. So now, you know, what do you think about that?
Well, I do think that the abuse is widespread. I mean, the numbers that the people are generally working with is that 30% is by family members, 60% by those known and trusted by the victim, known
right.
to family.
Back up again. I want to hear those statistics again. How much?
That it's actually 60% that of abusers are known to the family and trusted
right.
by the family and individual.
Okay.
And so that could be any number of people, teachers or, you know, sports
right.
leaders and clergy. And I guess
Does that include family members? Does that 60% include family members?
No, it does not. So 30%
okay.
alone is incest.
How much?
30%.
So it's 30% incest, 60% somebody who's known to the family.
Yes.
And do we know what the remaining 10% is?
Well, that's you know, what it would be like random or strangers.
Yeah. yeah.
So a lot of attention is, especially down in Southern California, we had Amber Dubois and Chelsea King, and, you know, the focus on the stranger danger and all that. But the reality is that a lot more is in places that we would believe are safe, you know, the 60% in churches and clubs.
I'm actually surprised by your statistic because I kind of thought family would come up 60% and clergy would probably be 30. But that's interesting. So it's actually 60% is just known by the family.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I think any of those authority figures who misuse that trust and betray by abusing in whatever way, especially sexually, has a profound impact on individuals. And in fact, there is a lot of similarity in the impact of incest survivors and survivors of religious authority, sexual abuse, in part because we're dealing with a kind of a family in church, you know, a whole system where in a family, a lot of the people are saying, you know, they would blame the victim and they don't want to believe that the adult, you know, would do such harm because it would unravel the whole family. And so similarly in church, people have that similar investment in protecting the clergy person, because their whole identity and theology and sense of self and sense of God and the world and history, all that is wrapped up in clergy. So that makes clergy particularly toxic. In fact, there's a new strand, I guess, of studying PTSD called Complex Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, Religious Duress, and Sexual Abuse.
Huh.
And so it's got its own category because it is a little bit different in that it's wrapped up in these, you know, huge social, you know, dynamics as well. But I think it's all about power, and so anyone who doesn't come in to that role with a sense of managing their own boundaries and being clear about the power that they take up and represent can hurt people. And I think the difficulty and what's trickier about clergy is that I think people generally still hold clergy in such high esteem. And there's a way of, you know, people not seeing and not questioning what a clergy person will do that is different, I think, the way people might question what someone else would do around kids. You know, and so in a sense, we see what we believe instead of believe what we see. I mean, some people might see a clergy person being, you know, spending way too much time with some kids or kissing, you know, kids or holding them inappropriately. But we, you know, we believe that they would never have any bad intent. And so, you know, we don't allow ourselves to actually see that. So I think that that's what makes clergy abuse even harder to see, harder to name, harder to confront. But I don't know that it's any more widespread than teachers or than others who take up you know, roles of trust. And not too long ago, there was in U.S. Swim, you know, the premier swimming team that feeds our Olympic team. There's
uh-huh.
some stories about abuse there. So it could happen in any setting, you know, where people have access to kids, they have this power, they have this great trust, they have privacy where, you know, where they shouldn't, and when they have ways, you know, to control the kids, to manipulate and you know, develop this such an allegiance and loyalty that, you know, the kid is really powerless.
So let's talk about that power for just a minute, because I know, you know, as somebody who is trained in, you know, in rape intervention, I've worked for a volunteered for a center against rape and domestic violence. The model that we always worked from was that rape is not really a form of sex; it's a form of a violence, which is all
yes.
about power. It's about having
yes.
power over the victim.
Yes.
And you just mentioned that incest is about power. So, do we think that you know, people who molest children are pedophiles, or, you know, do we think that the vast majority of people who molest aren't really necessarily clinically a pedophile, but rather somebody who has issues with wanting to be powerful? Or how does that break down in your professional opinion?
Well, I don't know the percentages, but I do know that, you know, people who abuse kids or vulnerable adults are described in three categories. You know, one is the preferential abuser, molester, who really seek out vulnerable people, kids who may be shy or isolated, who need extra attention, or even who are troublemakers, who don't have a voice, who don't have a sense of their own boundaries or their own bodies. Then there are those who are, I guess, just kind of convenience, you know, like because there's an opportunity and they have this bias or this sense of abusing, that they will take advantage of people and it would be called situational molesters. And others are more indiscriminate, more sadistic, and I guess that's where that 10%, you know, stranger danger would come in. So the first group would really depend on a relationship. The second group, a bit of a relationship, but wouldn't, you know, have gone through this grooming process, this, you know, forethought. So I believe that the first and the second are the most common, but I don't know the statistics on those.
So running through that again, let's see if I got it right. So there's the first group is situational or opportunistic?
The first group is preferential. Those are the people like my abuser who take the time to develop a relationship and trust and get known to the family and groom the kid to, you know, do things that they wouldn't normally do And then.
So this type of person really is a pedophile.
Yes.
They're not interested in sex with adults.
Well, for the most part, I believe so.
Okay. And then the other is situational, meaning that opportunistic, meaning that it happens to be available, and so they go for it.
Yes.
Okay. And then the last category was that 10% that is some kind of a, like, rape and murder?
I think that I described it as, like, indiscriminate, just not depending on some kind of prior relationship.
Okay.
And I think the dynamics are there for vulnerable adults as well. I mean, it's not just kids who are the victims.
Right. Well, for people who are the stranger danger stuff.
Yes.
No?
Well, really for all of them. I mean, there are adults who are groomed and, you know, betrayed by authority figures as well. There are vulnerable adults who have the similar characteristics as vulnerable kids.
Well, the question always comes up. This is, you know, this is pretty common. Do we think that people are going to the Catholic Church because they think here is access to all these altar boys? Or are they joining the Catholic Church with good intentions, and then the vow of celibacy somehow or another causes them to start molesting the kids that are, you know, within their grasp? So, I mean, I suppose this is kind of a chicken or egg argument, but I think a lot of people, you know, have different theories on whether or not they think pedophiles are flocking to positions of religious authority, or if in fact something about the religious dogma itself is tending to, for lack of a better word, pervert the sexual urges of the clergy.
Well, Richard Seif has written a lot about celibacy, and you know, he's pretty clear that it's not a factor in abusing kids. You know, that there are people who are breaking their celibacy with adults and doing a lot of things, messing with boundaries and so on, that it's not about celibacy causing pedophilia. In fact, you know, there's a group called Stop Baptist Predators, and you're going to speak next week with somebody from the Jewish tradition. And so there are a lot of married clergy who still prey on vulnerable kids and adults. So the celibacy piece isn't the cause. It's just part of, you know, that tradition. And that, you know, some people think that it's homosexuality. Okay, so if people can't openly marry or whatever, they go into religion and they go into, you know, Catholicism, and that's, you know, not a correlation either. It's not sexual orientation. So I think that the Catholic experience has been more documented. When I talk to church folks a lot of times, I mean, when we look at the Catholic experience, I mean, it is what it is because people have done the wrong things in responding, you know, and instead of listening and acknowledging, you know, what the person is saying and offering some kind of pastoral, call it support, you know, people deny or minimize or lie, and, you know, and then people find out later, you know, that they were lied to, and that's why people resort to lawsuits. And the Catholic story is much more documented, but I don't think it's that different from other denominations or traditions.
Okay. Well, and fair enough. There was quite a bit of stir about what to do with pedophiles once they've been found out. And I don't know, you know, how you're going to feel about some of this. I know for myself that when I listen to the rage that people have about people who molest children, that as a survivor myself, I always feel like it's an expenditure of energy that doesn't do me a lot of good. Mm. But I'll give you some for instances here. Some of these ideas I like better than others. But, you know, Hannah says put them in prison. Mm-hmm. Solo says molest them. So, you know, kind of an eye for an eye there. Cameron says get a rope. Dave says give the parents 5 minutes in a room alone with that person, instant street justice, then send them in jail. Arthur says castrate them in the town square and then pour acid on their open wounds. Mm. Nicholas, I thought, had perhaps some more feasible solutions. I think these are things that the law enforcement has actually entertained, such as possibly embedding a transmitter, chemically castrating them, hooking up radio collars, so that we always know where they are. And I'm just wondering, what do you think about that? Oh, and making their photo public to try to shame them. What do you think about some of the responses that people have? It does seem a lot of times that they want to hurt them. But does this really solve the problem, and does it do anything for survivors?
Well, it's controversial. What a great thing to bring up. And I think the more people talk, the more people vent, that we'll eventually get to, I think, a more sustainable kind of response. Because I get the rage of wanting to have 5 minutes, to hurt the person who abused me. I get, the rage, I've heard it from survivors, I've felt it myself, about wanting something to happen to that person. And so that really doesn't, those are the feelings, I think, of when people are dealing with that raw emotion and pain. But that doesn't help the person to heal. That's just as, acknowledging, that we're full of rage.
Right.
So there, anybody who abuses, this is criminal behavior, should go to jail, no question. As far as rehabilitation, I mean, the shaming thing isn't rehabilitating. A few years ago, if I had the experience of a registered sex offender coming to the church that I am a member of, and wanting to participate, wanting to be open and up front, doing his work, treatment, and, being accountable. I think that's a healthier and more difficult way to engage with people who have this background, like people who are, doing some kind of recovery, to have some accountability and to know who they are rather than, and not know who they are in a way to expose them to more hostility, because that only puts people under more pressure and is no good for anybody. That's the controversial part, because some people may hear it as like, wow, this guy's just saying, don't do anything or it's okay, and I'm absolutely not. But I think at some point we have to shift and be able to let go of the destructive rage to channel it and to find ways, that we can know who's doing what and hold them accountable. But we don't have enough prisons. We don't have enough islands. A lot of suggestions people have made to lock people up. Only 3% of abusers are known, and on these registered sex offender lists. That means that there's an awful lot of other people who want to work or go to church with us who are abusers in some way.
For myself, it reminds me of culturally, if it takes back a few hundred years ago, or that we wanted to castigate anybody who had committed adultery. And yet, it's incredibly common behavior. But, the good people, quote-unquote, would take great delight in, basically indicting somebody who'd gotten found out. And I come from a family of pedophiles, so, aunts that were molested by uncles. Mostly in my family, it was the uncles. And then the grandfather. It's ridiculous. It's like, it's like almost both sides of the family are infected with this, what I consider a family disease. And when people talk about wanting to put those people in prison or kill them, it's hard for me to wrap my mind around how that's going to solve anything when I see a pattern of passing this on from generation to generation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that sometimes people can be at their most hostile in reaction to a particular piece of information when it strikes closest to home.
Sure.
It's like, we want to have a violent reaction to it, perhaps because we're terrified that someone in our family or someone in our acquaintance or even perhaps ourselves could be possibly capable of doing something even remotely related to that. And I was in a treatment starting back in 1985 when I first got sober. And this treatment program, they don't have anything like it now, but it was called Parents United. And it was awesome because we had support groups for survivors. And then if at any time in your recovery you wanted to face a perpetrator, there were meetings for that where you could actually go in and sit in the room with other people's perpetrators. Now, what I found about that was it really gave voice to our pain, but it also humanized the perpetrator. And, you know, I mean, what in this particular treatment modality, our perpetrators, other people's perpetrators, were not strangers, nor were they members of the clergy. They were, you know, survivors' parents, their mothers and their fathers. So, anyway, I don't know if you've ever had an opportunity to face somebody else's perpetrator. I think there's a lot of healing to do in that, but if it's in a controlled situation where you're not allowed to actually hurt them.
Right. No, I think that's it's a very powerful way for people to get to work with, you know, their own experiences and to move beyond that, to expand that. I mean, actually, when that registered sex offender showed up at this church, I became, for like 6 months, a member of this support team for this person. As everybody figured out, well, can they be here or not, I met weekly with a few other people with this person, and it was the hardest thing I had ever done up to that point. But over time, I did see this person as more of a person and not as a projection of all the rage that I had about anybody who had ever hurt me or others. And I think that in Canada, the Truth and Reconciliation process that started a couple years ago has that goal to have people be face-to-face, and that's not possible for a lot of people. But I think, you know, if that is and it is controlled and people aren't going to be, you know, hurting each other, it opens up a different kind of healing. It certainly did for me. I started to shift and to let go of a lot of my own rage and be more compassionate. And so, we have to work differently. It's just the way it is. And it's probably easier, more comforting somehow to think that if we lock people up or just pass enough laws that somehow the problem is going to be gone, when, you know, the sex trafficking that, you know, is in our society, is in the world, you know, that's a huge issue that we need to deal with. And, you know, the work that I do with congregations or church folks is to help the average person to have some skills to believe what they see and to intervene and to challenge, you know, and to think for themselves. And I think, you know, the more that we can have everybody engaging, so I really appreciate the conversation, you know, that everybody thinks through, you know, that what we've done in the past isn't sufficient. You know, the problem is bigger. And as much as it might, you know, be a good revenge in order to hurt, you know, perpetrators, the reality is that we all have hurt people. You know, and that was part of my own processes when I realized, okay, I was abandoned, abused, and shamed, and then I did that to myself. And while I didn't sexually abuse other people, I mean, I was abusive. I was perfectionist. I was shaming to other people. I was, you know, a hard colleague to work with. I did some good things, but, you know, and so I have to realize that other people are in therapy because of me.
Well, in my father's case, he absolutely abhorred what his older brother had done. His older brother had raped his stepdaughter. My father was horrified, wanted to send him to prison, thought it was despicable. And then he turned around and molested his own daughters. But, you know, each time, from each subsequent generation, the molestation takes on different forms so that, you know, each parent can, well, I'm not doing what the other person did. I feel pretty confident that what I'm doing is healthy and right. But unless you get intervention from an outside source to really tell you, you know, what is normal, what's natural, for some families especially, there isn't a sense of normalcy.
And that's not
a good reference point.
Yeah, and so, I mean, that's where, to me, the workbook really helps people to gauge, you know, like this is what I've experienced, but that's not real healthy. You know, this is the way I behaved, and it's not real healthy. So what might be next? I mean, I didn't have that even in support groups that I went to and I led for a long time. It was just kind of recycling rage and just, you know, feeling depressed.
Sure.
And doing that with other people and feeling better about that, but not really having a next step, not really, you know, growing. And so I think we do all need to, you know, learn our way through.
Well, there is, you know, let's face it, if you are 30 and younger, you probably got the good touch, bad touch speech in school. But if you're older than 30, there's a chance that nobody ever really sat down with you and told you, this is what is okay and this is not what's okay. You know, so I mean, just like some very basics about, you know, what is acceptable kind of touching. And we've gotten so touch phobic now, you know, that a school teacher can't
right.
even hug a child if they
right.
scrape their knee, which
right.
I think is kind of sad. We've gone the other extreme.
Yeah,
but
we've done a lot.
I want to tell you, we've got about 1 minute left here.
Okay.
And I would love to give you a chance to tell our listeners how to get a copy of your workbook and also anything else maybe you think we've left out this evening.
Well, thanks. The workbook is available. You can go to my website, which is my name, JaimeRomo.com, or you can go to Amazon, and actually it's now as an e-book. You can get it through Kindle or Nook. And I just put up as an e-book a simple and I think a helpful guide for parents called Parents Preventing Abuse, and that's in English and in Spanish. And so, you know, the conventional Barnes & Nobles and Amazon and e-books are always. I think that this is something that I've gotten great feedback from therapists, from people working with therapists, survivors. I think every church, every you know, really home would benefit by having a copy, and I would love feedback. So go to my website and send me an email, and you know, I'd be happy to come to different groups and present and help folks to understand, you know, how to manage their own boundaries and how to deal with creating a safe a place where people can really be healed. Because the reality is that so many people, all of us, have wounds that you know, we carry around for too long. And so that's my goal, is to help every church and every group, you know, to be healthy and to be a place where people can let go of that past stuff and really be freed up.
Well, thank you. I applaud your work, and thank you, Dr. Romo, for joining us in the Shame-Free Zone.
Thanks so much.
Okay. I'm going to have to sign off here. See y'all next Monday. Happy New Year.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with me. Sering kesepian, kenapa tak mutus kabar berita?